On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Thomas Frederick and Joshua Walk about counseling and integrationism and all sorts of things related to that. So naturally, you cover topics like what is counseling, what are the various models, when did counseling in its modern form become really prevalent, would Reformed Christians of the past even recognize it today, and what should we make of the integrationist debate? Can we use secular sources for Christian counseling, and much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now, for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and I am alone today without Brandon Askew, but I'm going to plan to have a lot of fun anyway because we've got two awesome guests with us. So if you don't know anything about us, we're a podcast that's devoted to serious thinking for a serious church, and we try to do that by cultivating and creating sort of an intellectual culture of charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So the way we think about that is that's a big way of saying we want to be serious thinkers in the sense of being rigorous in our thinking. We want to really pursue the best arguments and the best modes of thinking that we can. But it also means that we do it with a virtuous sort of disposition in kindness and charity and just caring for the other person, caring for other people's arguments enough to not strawman them, to give them the best shake that they can. So that's what we're trying to produce, or I guess produce and promote here at the London Lyceum. We're not perfect, but hopefully if we repeat it enough, it will encourage us to do those sort of things and say, this is a vision that I can catch on to that I want to promote. And me and Brandon, we're both Reformed Baptists, but man, we have all sorts of people on the podcast. I mean, if you listen regularly, you'll know you have the whole gauntlet of people across ranges of denominations. I mean, I think we're probably stick somewhat in the Reformed-ish orbit for the most part, but we've got everybody and you have Episcopalians, you have Roman Catholics, you have everybody coming on the show, and we try to treat them with respect and honor, and we really enjoy it. So today we have two guys who I think are closer to us, and I'm really looking forward to interviewing them on just the broad topic of counseling. I mean, there's lots of questions that go on with this. I think I was at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, sort of one of the hotbeds for, I guess, what's called biblical counseling. And there is a sense of which, when I was there anyway, biblical counseling is the way. There is no other way. Rule with an iron fist. So I know that there is quite a bit of discussion about this. So I'm excited to just sort of chat about it a little bit with two guys. So I'm going to let them introduce themselves. We have Josh Walk and Tom Frederick, and I'll let them talk about where they're at right now, what they're doing. But I also want to know what made them interested in learning about counseling and deciding to practice counseling and deciding to, I think, in Tom, in your case, teach it at a college as well. So Josh, I'll let you start. And then Tom, you follow up after Josh gives his little think 2 to 3 minute spiel on who you are and how you got into it.
Sure. Thanks, Jordan. It's a privilege and an honor to be here on the London Lyceum tonight. Love the show and listen frequently. I'm Josh Walk, founder, executive director, along with my wife here at Baylight Counseling Inc. We're down here in Tampa Bay in Florida, on the other West Coast. But on the East Coast of Florida, it's really confusing. But anyway, Baylight is a Christian nonprofit. We're a donor-supported 501c3. We exist to provide local churches here in Tampa Bay with a viable counseling alternative, a place where they can send their folks for longer-term care, dedicated counseling for the range of issues for which people typically will seek out counseling services: depression, anxiety, marriage concerns, parenting concerns, and things of the like. Along with my wife, we've been doing this since May of 2013. And although I had heard of biblical counseling prior to landing at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in 2011, it was probably after taking one or two courses that I really fell in love with this particular stream of vocational ministry. And after spending some time with Sam Williams there at Southeastern, decided to dedicate myself to equipping for this particular kind of ministry. while I was there, and that kind of set the course for the last 9 years of our lives.
So I'm Tom Frederick. I'm currently the director of the Master of Science in Counseling Psychology program at California Baptist University. And so basically what that is that these are students that are interested in becoming equipped to take the MFT license for the state of California. This is a professional degree program. And so I've been interested in psychology and counseling since I took my first undergrad general psych class back in the day at Geneva College, which is part of the Reformed Presbyterian Church of America. And so I remember long nights in the dining hall in my dorm, a very anti-psychology place. So all the students there were like, "What are you doing? It's of the devil. Are you worshiping Satan? Did you bow to Molech yet or something like that?" And so I spent a long time kind of forming in that kind of a context. Came to Fuller Seminary. I graduated from the School of Psychology in Fuller Seminary with a marital family therapy degree. I'm a licensed therapist in the state of California. And so in terms of one of the other options besides biblical counseling is what we would talk about is an integrative piece. I'm guessing that we'll probably get into that integrative dimension as we go through our conversation. I'm not currently practicing, but I'm a licensed therapist. I've got, some experience with addiction, depression, anxiety, couples, adults, and a lot of my clinical experience was in treating criminals, violent offenders, people that are arrested for drug abuse, drug-related kinds of things. So, yeah, it's a little bit about
cool. Super helpful. So let's before we jump into sort of the meat of the conversation, give me the basic level definitions of when we think counseling within the Christian sphere. So I don't really care about the secular stuff. I'm interested in the Christian understanding of counseling. What are the different models and approaches? I know we've mentioned biblical counseling. We've mentioned this integration piece. Don't give me the pros or cons. Just define it for me. So Tom, start with maybe you just try to give me a taxonomy. And then Josh, if you feel like he missed anything or you'd nuance anything, you can jump in after that.
So from a Christian perspective, I think generally speaking, counseling is teaching, admonition, supporting someone to transform, to grow. And specifically in Christian terms, we would want them to become more Christ-like more Christ-like. And so one of the more popular approaches now that really is trying to develop a Christianized view is what we would consider Christian psychology. And it's very applied that way. And so there would be components of that that would be looking at traditional spiritual disciplines, contemplative prayer, meditative Bible reading, that kind of thing. And now that was emerging as I was finishing seminary. So we were much more in an integrative piece, which would be looking at how science of psychology and psychotherapy fits into more of a biblical model or a theological approach, but which would be very different than what the biblical counselors would believe. But so I think those are like the main options. There's the integrative piece, the biblical piece, and then maybe Christian counseling in the literature. There's a couple other models there, but those are the main ones.
Cool. What say you, Josh?
Yeah, I like all of what Tom had to say. I would probably describe myself as, if we think of biblical counseling specifically as occurring on a spectrum, as most things do, I probably would locate myself maybe left of center within biblical counseling, if that means anything. I'm not one. I don't think that we have any liberal, progressive Christian types within the biblical counseling realm, but we still exist on a spectrum. And so I'm one who's probably more interested and more open to things, influences, helps that come to us from outside of our unique tribe, if I can use that word. So a lot of the things that Tom is talking about are things that are of interest to me, and specifically in the context of how do they make us as biblical counselors, how can they help make us better, more useful to the people that we serve? So, I think that's probably why Tom and I, have kind of connected and find a lot of common ground, even though we kind of come to the counseling endeavor from some slightly different places in our origination.
Yeah. So I guess when you're thinking biblical counseling, there's a spectrum. The spectrum relates to how do we think about things outside of the Bible for counseling help. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Okay. So I think the stereotype that I was kind of presented in as an integrationist, and this is reflected even in literature of the early 2000s, is that the biblical counseling movement is only focused on what the Bible says and does. That's the sole role of kind of human nature, psychotherapy techniques, things you should do. And then ultimately, I think some of this stems from probably the ways in which Jay Adams presented himself in conferences in the 70s as being very confrontational. He kind of reminds me of the Albert Ellis of the biblical counseling movement. That is very, I was going to use a pejorative word. He was very confrontational, very upfront, and basically it always seemed like the client needed to be proselytized, and that was the sole goal of biblical counseling. But that's changed, especially since about 2010, 2008. I noticed a shift in the literature that way. It's really refreshing to me because, from an integration perspective, biblical counselors really weren't part of our conversation. Like they were so outside of it, and they were solely connected to the Bible piece. So they really weren't invited to the conversations that integration folks were having at that point.
We were the IFB of counseling.
You can cut I'll quote you after. On that, Josh. okay, before I ask you some questions more about the specifics on, what you think makes sense, more sense, and makes less sense. Give me a little bit of history. I mean, how in the world did we get to this place in modern culture where counseling is where it's at? Is there any precursors that we see, whether that's in the Reformation or the medieval church or other places that you say they are practicing counseling in a similar mode or way that we're thinking of it today? Because, I mean, when I look and I just imagine my intuitions, you can tell me I'm wrong because I don't have any data to say I've read all this stuff to know what happened in the medieval church or the patristic church or whatever. It doesn't seem to me that there's a lot of counseling in the modern sense that was ongoing. Maybe unless it was a pastoral, actual pastoral sort of counseling. But outside of that, it doesn't seem that there were people who functioned as counselors. So just give me that sort of arc of history. What's happened? How did it change? How did we get here?
I'm punting that one to Tom.
Oh, okay. So I'll use a more specific example. So, and if this doesn't work, Jordan, please let me know, and maybe I can come up with a different one. But initially, right, what we know about human dysfunction came from a lot of the records the priests used to take during confession. And so we would learn about like catalogs of sins, and some of that in some ways landed in what we would consider the DSM in the 1950s when it started to come out. But going back to the Catholic priest piece and the confession part, it was very much a shared worldview, we might say, where what causes people to do bad stuff is sin, right? Either they were sinned against, and then they were sinning outward, right? And so that meant then the confession, there it is. Well, that's the newest one. And they keep threatening of a text revision, so I'm sure it's on the horizon. And so so there was that shared worldview, right? Because psychotherapy has to be connected to what's wrong. What's the nature of problems? And so we'll jump now into the 1800s, and there's the medicalization of all kinds of human ailments, right? We learned about bacteria and all this other stuff, and so then people began to understand human problems aren't necessarily a sin issue. There might be biological or neurochemical or some other kinds of maybe, you know, empirical or medical reasons for it. And then in the 50s, there was a shared worldview for psychotherapy, but that has since gone the way of the wayside. And so we're in this malaise now where, you know, Josh held up that book, right? So I go through the list of symptoms. I plug in whatever, out pops, you know, major depressive disorder. And I still don't know what to do to fix it. It just tells me what's there. And then some of the literature says I should do CBT. Some says I need to get my client on CBT and some psychotropics, all this stuff. And so it's this really mixed bag. Some of it's medical. Some of it's psychotherapy. Some of it is tied to a Christian perspective, like cognitive behavioral therapy techniques, right? Thinking, managing one's thoughts. People have been doing that since the beginning of recorded history, and you know, prayer is a form of meditation, and Buddhist meditation is really popular right now. So there are these hints that we see, but I agree. I don't think an ancient pastor would be like, "Hey, I recognize what you're doing." There's just no way.
Okay, well, let's just take it more specific. So, Reformed, you know, let's just take the Westminster Confession, the Westminster Assembly. Would they, in any sense, any of those delegates, recognize either the biblical counseling movement or other counseling movements within Christianity, whether that's Christian psychology or the integrationist approach? Would they say, I know it's anachronistic to do that, but just for fun, say, like, with their own theological framework in mind, would you think that they would say, yes, this is a healthy approach to helping people become more Christ-like and grow towards wholeness? Or would they reject it out and say, no, you just need the ordinary means of grace. Just show up to church on Sunday morning and Sunday evening, and that's enough.
Well, I think that's that's a tough question, at least for me to answer. I wouldn't put myself out there as an authority on the divines. However, I think when we read the body of you know, we scan that body of literature that the Reformation era produced, I think we see enough concern for the care of souls in a variety of ways. Certainly, the problems that we face today may have really taken on some different contours from how they were experiencing them. But there's nothing new under the sun. How they're expressed might change in some ways, but Martin Bucer was concerned enough about the care of souls that he gave a book that title. Does it read different than a CBT manual does today? Even one that is, coming from an integrationist perspective? Sure, maybe it does. But I think if we carefully read them and we carefully read what some of what we're producing today, I think that there are some clear lines of similarity. I don't think that we have to close ourselves off from what they had to say. And in fact, I would submit that we'd be doing ourselves a great disservice if we did that.
That's helpful. So I want to know more about the integrationist debate now. So talk to me a little bit about that. I mean, what should we make of the debate? How do we think about how much of these secular sources can we use? What's the role of medicine? I mean, even as I think now, as we're recording, I feel like a week ago, I saw a whole bunch of reports or something. I didn't read any of the articles so that I could. This is 100% on me if I'm inaccurate, but I feel like the headlines were saying that the studies were saying that depression is not caused by like chemical imbalances in the brain, which is what seemed to be the prevailing theory for I don't know how many years it's been. And then I see all these people posting this Tom Cruise video that was incredibly fascinating, but also really awkward to watch as they went back and forth. But it was super interesting. So just walk me through a little bit in your own context. What do you think about it? How do you understand it? How do you walk through that?
So this is a great question, Jordan. So I think for me, like what, coming from an integrationist perspective, and this is where I did not benefit from the biblical counselors, is that there were no kind of guidelines or delimiting factors in terms of thinking about epistemology, natural theology, and how these things really help us orient. All right, so we start with the position, all truth is God's truth. I mean, everybody would, especially from a Reformed perspective, would say, absolutely. But then, you know, with the literature that I've been reading, and it's even now it's going on, there's what that tends to mean is that the theological pieces are fit into, integrated with, maybe assimilated might be a better term, with the psychological components therein, right? And so we're trained, it's a chemical imbalance or some kind of brain dysfunction. And so that means as a counselor, a professor, I teach my students, okay, you've gone through the DSM, you've got this diagnosis. Okay, we understand there are some biological or neurochemical components. You might want to send your client to a medical doctor for a while, but you need both, right? So the research indicates that both are important, talking cure and psychotropics. And then in some cases of really severe depression, psychotherapy actually outperforms the psychotropics, like in people with very severe depression. And so I think what's happened is since we've medicalized psychological problems, human problems, right, we want to throw pills at it. And so a lot of people don't go to their physicians. I mean, I don't know if this has happened to you guys, but every time I go into my doctor, I take the a mental health screen. And all the doctor does is make sure I clicked more ones or zeros than ones. And then even at that, I've been asked, "Oh, do you need any Zoloft? Do you need anything?" And I'm like, "No, I'm okay. By the way, that's a horrible way to assess somebody's mental health." And they're like, "Oh, okay." And so we've medicalized it, right? And so we need the talking cure and we need the medical part. But specifically, as I understand it, it was one of the theories, biological theories of depression. As some evidence is coming out and suggesting that it doesn't quite work. Or it doesn't kind of fit the what's happening on in the brain that way, and so the epistemological piece is really important, and the biblical counseling people really have helped me kind of think through, okay, what are my commitments epistemologically, right? Does the Bible as God's rule of faith does that trump what's going on in terms of the psychotherapy, the psychological knowledge that we have, and what is the relationship between that, and how can natural theology, for example, help me to kind of discern and evaluate these potentially different truth claims that way.
So, Josh, how what's your framework for thinking about these things?
My framework was, I think, in many ways, established early on when I began my training in biblical counseling. It was made clear, taught, and it was clear to me in Scripture that to be human was to possess a body and a soul, that the effects of the fall infect, and influence every square inch of our humanity. And so it never, although there may have been a progression for me to kind of continue learning what this meant, but over the course of time, it became clear to me that we wouldn't be surprised that man would suffer in his soul. And he would also suffer in his body, and that includes the brain. We know more today, I think I can fairly say, we know more about the brain today than at any time in human history. I think that as Christian counselors, therapists, psychologists, whatever words in between, we know more today about the body-soul intersection than perhaps at any time in human history. But the more we learn, the more aware we become of just how much we don't know. And so it's a very awe-inspiring conversation that is happening both theologically and also on the scientific side of all of this. So I probably early in my biblical counseling career, and maybe this is still true today, probably needed a lot more humility in my understanding than I had. And so, you know, just trying to embrace some of those things today and recognizing that we I think, serve our neighbor well when we're open to dialogues that has to do with the way in which the body is also influencing how people feel, think, act, speak. And I don't think we serve them well when we are just quick to dismiss that part of the conversation.
So it seems to me part of the challenge with this area is counseling, thinking about people's mental health is so close to how just scripture talks in general. Like scripture is helping people think, you know, pure thoughts, holy thoughts, these sort of things, where these realms are overlapping to a huge degree, where when I tell somebody, you know, the Bible isn't sufficient for you, a sufficient manual for you how to like change your oil on your truck, everybody's like, well, yeah, duh. That seems like, obviously, it's not an instruction manual for me to step one, step two, step three, but it seems that when it comes to counseling, that seems like that's under this realm of Christian theology much, much more. So maybe I want to know, both of you answer this a little bit differently, I'd like. So Tom, tell me, when do you, in your mind, do you say the limit is for, this is too much integration, we need to return back to thinking a little bit more biblically about some things? And then Josh, after that, I want to know for you, when do you say, I need to use some more sources than just a Bible verse? The Bible, I'm not saying the Bible isn't sufficient, the only final rule for, you know, all faith practice, those sort of things. When it comes to counseling in particular, like, when is it that I need to take an extra tool off the shelf to bring this up a notch? So Tom, I'll let you start.
Well, that's great. This isn't a controversial question at all, Jordan. And I won't get into any trouble with my answer at all. So don't, this is great. So
Jordan is questioning the sufficiency of scripture.
Oh, I didn't hear that question at all.
No, he's not. I was just kidding, people. Just kidding.
So I think, let me answer this question, Jordan, in a couple of ways. First off, there are clear legal parameters that, because I'm a licensed therapist in the state of California, or any therapist would be, a licensed therapist would be under these parameters, I can't proselytize. So if a person came in and even in, as part of this counseling session, like they would be like, you know, I really need Jesus, and I might agree completely with that, I would refer them out to a couple of trusted pastors or churches, because that would be a limit, right? The law is preventing me from doing something like that. Now, there are a couple other areas in there. So in 2008, when California went for the gay marriage, the homosexual marriage, that brought up a lot of challenges, especially for those of us that are Christian and might hold to a traditional perspective on marriage. So then how do you treat couples, especially homosexual couples, that kind of a thing? And then, of course, now we're into even more initials after the LGBT thing with some signs and stuff in there as well. And so then the question becomes, how do we be salt and light in a situation like that when there are so many political and professional and mental health ramifications? And it's a really difficult space to be in that way. And so one of the things that I do regularly is integration for me is about the person of the therapist. So my identity as a Christian, as a Bible-believing white male here in the United States, that's who I am in the counseling session. Now, I share more of that with some folks, maybe by praying with them, maybe by opening the Bible and sharing some scriptures and talking about more theologically explicit theological themes. But myself, my identity, who I am, but through the power of Christ, in that moment, shares God's life with them. And so I'm hoping that I'm perturbing them to whatever situation they're in, to be more aligned with Christ and his word as we see it in the Bible. And so that's kind of how I approach this and conceptualize this. And I don't perceive myself to be in violation of my theological or my professional ethics in the way that I'm practicing at this moment. Now, that might change in the future. I don't know what the future is going to hold, but right now, that's kind of where I'm at in this space.
So a very basic explanation of how we at Baylight, my wife and I, will approach this question that you've posed. Whenever we're meeting with someone for counseling, one of the things that we're seeking to do is as we gather data, as we establish a rapport with them, you know, establish a healthy relationship with them, is I'm looking for continuity between what they're describing and what they're experiencing. If someone comes in and through the process of our conversation, there seems to be a gap between their experience, what the symptoms, if you will, that they're experiencing, and the circumstances of their life, that might give rise or give raise concern that perhaps this isn't a circumstantial or a circumstantially driven concern. Perhaps there's a biological component to what they're experiencing, whether it's a biological issue that's at the root of the problem. I'm willing to perfectly open to that possibility. And I'm also open to the possibility that their circumstantially driven difficulty has produced the fruit of biological difficulties. I'm not a medical doctor, and I don't play one on TV. So I'm very happy to refer that person to their medical doctor. I'm very happy to work with their medical team, and we do regularly here at Baylight. We are happy to work with anybody's medical doctor in the course of their care. We see that not as being at odds with biblical counseling, but actually being in harmony with Scripture, because I want the person in front of me to be well in their mind, and I want them to be well in their body. And so I'm very happy to refer people out for medical care, or at least a checkup, anytime there's any reason to think that could be at issue.
That's good. That's helpful. So we've talked a little bit about ideas. I want to get a slightly more practical. So we have a lot of pastors who listen to the podcast. And I think, Tom, you mentioned just those three areas of addiction, depression, and anxiety. I mean, how should pastors approach those specific things? Because to me, it seems like these are becoming more and more and more common. All the time, I'm seeing more people who are addicted to more stuff, who are more depressed, who are more anxious. It's just like, it feels like everybody is more anxious, more depressed. So what would you encourage pastors to begin doing or to begin thinking about? Maybe it's, here's an inventory you should just have in your back pocket when you're talking to somebody just off the cuff, or maybe there are more probing questions or just ways that you could say these are some commonalities between people who are experiencing these things that have served to benefit them. Just give me your best advice. Tom, you can start.
Sure. So I think for me, especially in terms of the addiction piece, like if I was a pastor and I had I would have those resources handy. So I would have the like national 12-step programs, Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, CODA. I would have those numbers available. So if a parishioner or a congregant came in and they're like, you know, Pastor, it's really hard for me to tell you that I've been, you know, I drink, you know, a six pack a night. And then I wash that down with, you know, a quart of Jim Beam or something or whatever. And so they're like, okay, well, that's a problem. It sounds like you've got a problem. And then maybe if the pastor, if it's a small church, the pastor might even want to offer going with the person to those initial meetings. Now, this is something important. So there are different levels of 12-step meetings. Some are very educational, kind of like the ones you see in the movie. But then there are much more intimate settings where you're actually working through the steps and you get a sponsor. Now, that's the level where the pastor would want to kind of disinvest himself from, to because the person at that point is in really good care for the most part. And then, you know, I would, as a pastor, after I had the client or the congregant rather, I'm sorry, in that position, I'd keep checking in with them. So how's it going? Because what we know is that level of addiction has horrible ramifications for the marriage, for the kids, jobs. I mean, just usually people with addiction, by the time they come for help, their lives are usually in a mess. And so there's a lot of other supports that the pastor can do. And the pastor can play a really important role in the recovery for that part, but then also in developing wellness later on, supporting the wife, supporting the kids, making sure everybody's safe. You know, if it's couples counseling, you know, you might want to ask, the pastor might want to separately ask the spouse, so what do you do when he's drunk and he wants to take the kids to Dairy Queen? How do you manage that? And what do you need to do there? And what's a safety plan? Have you ever thought about, you know, doing what you need to do so you can be safe, so you and the kids can be safe? And then, you know, we'll deal with the ramifications when the person's not recovered but sober, right? You really can't do anything when someone's under the influence that way. So those would be some of my suggestions. I would recommend not coming in heavy-handed and all, you know the Paul said that kind of thing, right? No, I wouldn't do that. I'd want to be supportive, make sure people are safe, and then work toward the recovery piece.
Yeah, I agree with what Tom shared. It's been a historic plan for us here at Baylight to recognize that when someone comes in, as happens with an active moderate to acute addiction issue, chemical, I think we're talking about chemical addiction type stuff here. It's pretty much a standard affair for us to get them connected as best we can to some kind of in what I'll call an inpatient treatment scenario. You know, my background, between my background in law enforcement, you know, over the course of 17 years and then, you know, our 9 years here at Baylight, has really impressed upon me that until you get a person to a place of physical, clear physical sobriety, the work that we would be most concerned about influencing their mind, influencing their heart, is just simply not going to get off the ground, or at least it's going to be significantly hampered. I'd rather get someone into a condition of physical sobriety, you know, whether that's, you know, whether that turns out to be 20 days, 30 days, 90 days, whatever it takes, if they can do it, if they have the resources, that sets them up much better to receive our counseling on the backside of that, because I'm just always very concerned about someone with an active, or, you know, maybe we might say an acute, ongoing addictive issue. We can have a great counseling session, but as soon as they walk out my door, all bets are off. And I'm just, very concerned, to not perpetuate that problem.
So one last thing I really want to get your feedback on. How important is it for pastors and others who are interested in helping people along with these sort of things to have a robust anthropology? And I'm assuming both of you are going to say it's very important. You can give me the pitch for it. And then if it is, give me the resource that you would say, you got to read this. if you want to have the most help in thinking through these things. Tom, you can start.
All right. So, absolutely. So that's theological anthropology is why I went to seminary for my training, because it's all about human nature, either a completely secular view or a completely sacred view that way. And so the two resources I would recommend, I'm just going to throw it out there, and then if people send me hate mail, that's okay. Owen Strawn, Australian, I think I got his name right. He wrote a book called Reenchanting Humanity in 2019. And that's one of the most thorough theological anthropologies that I've read that covers a lot of bases that really aren't talked about. So there's the usual stuff, male and female stuff, but then he gets into work and some other components that are becoming more popular in theological circles. I recommend that. Oh my gosh, the author's name just left me, but it's called The Logic of the Body. And it was published about the same time, which it's also a great book, because what you get in integration circles is what's known as non-reductionistic physicalism, which basically means that all the psychological, spiritual, mental functions are some sort of artifact of biological processes, that you really can't differentiate a soul from the brain. And there are some problems with that from a classical Christian perspective and among other perspectives. And The Logic of the Body speaks to that a little bit, or not a little bit, quite a bit rather. And that's those are two recommendations I would make for people interested in theological anthropology.
And that's Matthew Lepine, for those of you guys who are listening.
That's right.
So we actually did an interview with him a very long time ago. So I will link to that in the show notes so that you can go listen to him and be convinced to go buy his book. All right, Josh, give me your pitch and your resources.
I'd like to thank Tom for bringing up Dr. Lepine's book, because I owe Jordan a book review from like forever ago. So thanks for bringing that up, Tom.
We live to serve, Josh. We live to serve.
Okay, so this is probably some kind of a Reformed Sunday school answer, but I just love I love reading Calvin on man. The Institutes, in particular, were very formative for me, and I can just sit down and read them at any time and just feel like I've benefited when I walk away. In a more contemporary sense, two works that I think are helpful and good reads. The very accessible to a broad readership, I would say, Jeremy Pierre's book, The Dynamic Heart in Daily Life. Dr. Pierre is at Southern Seminary. I think I'm going to get this right, With All Your Heart by Dr. Craig Troxell at Westminster Seminary, California. Two good contemporary books that I have benefited from very much.
Awesome. Man, you guys have been spot on in this conversation. No one even got angry with each other. It's amazing. So, Tom, you're making fun of this. This is the heated topic here. And, Josh, we didn't even get the fun Twitter comments. What's going on there? So, everybody, you guys are listening. You should follow both these guys on Twitter. Josh, every other week he's off Twitter, but if he's on Twitter, go find him, follow him.
It's a love-hate relationship that me and right. Twitter have.
That's right. But one of the positive things is it brought us together. I met Josh over Twitter, and there's no way I'd ever meet him. And so that's good, but then Twitter's a cesspool at the same time.
You know,
it's a big deal. I mean, I am supposed to be at complete odds with Tom. He is a doctor of psychology. I mean, I'm supposed to be proselytizing him this whole show.
That's true.
He's supposed to see me as like a knuckle-dragging Neanderthal. But we're brothers and we love each other. And that's I've right. benefited from his writing specifically.
Oh, well, thanks.
That's awesome. And yeah, the whole Twitter thing, I mean, for me, I've met so many cool people and found so many good resources. You just have to be very self-controlled and very judicious in what comes into your feed for it to be a successful experience in any sense. And even then,
I'm not,
like,
Jordan. I need you to mentor me on Twitter.
I don't think I could be successful in that.
So, and Jordan, if I may, if and you can edit this out. It depends.
Go
on
for it, man.
But if pastors want to reach out to me, my DMs are usually open. And so if they have questions or if they need resources or if we want to make fun of Josh, you know, and that we can do all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I don't mind, because like the resource thing, I think, is one of my passions is supporting pastors. And seminary doesn't have enough time to deal intently with pastoral counseling unless you do kind of what Josh did and really focus on biblical counseling or some kind of professional pastoral counseling credential, which not a lot of people do.
Yeah, no, that's wise words and also very generous of you to offer that. So I think even in my own MDiv, I don't think counseling of any sort was required, so I didn't have to take anything related to that. So I think that's probably a similar background for a lot of guys who've had any training, that they just aren't prepared for the in-depth challenges that can present themselves in certain scenarios and cases. So if that's you and you want resources, then I guess you can go DM Tom. So sorry if you got 100 DMs tomorrow, whenever this drops and you're listening, but you can go ask him for some resources and he's offered to help. So that's awesome. So thank you guys for doing this. This has been a lot of fun. As always, you guys know this is the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.